Well, we're doing chapters 9 and 10, which are sort of, well, obviously at the heart of the Gospel, but they're sort of buried deep. There's some bits that are quite famous. You'll recognise a lot of it. For my money, John gets a bit same-ish in the middle. I sort of feel he could have missed out a couple of chapters and he wouldn't lose a lot, but that's probably not a very right thing to say. But let's do our usual trick, as in primary school, of reading round, shall we? I'll start and then Mike can do paragraph 1. The man born blind, this is chapter 9. There are plenty of small details to note in this vivid story, some of them reminders of what we've learnt before, including the first one, Mike.
Do you remember the range of meanings of Ego Eimi, sometimes an echo of the divine name Yahweh? Chapter 10 has two of the famous I Am sayings, I am the gate and I am the good shepherd. But chapter 9 has perhaps the most secular, theologically the least significant example of the phrase in the Gospel. He kept saying, I am the man.
Yeah. The great hubbub broke out when this guy was able to see, not surprisingly, and people were running around trying to sort it all out, and the Pharisees instituted a whole investigation into it, lasts the entire chapter. And people were running around saying, where is he, where is he? Because, of course, they're not quite sure what he looks like in the crowd. And he kept saying, Ego Eimi, Ego Eimi. Just a little example of how you can use the phrase perfectly grammatically with no theological undertones at all. It's the normal Greek way of saying, it's me, or I'm here. Do you see? So when I'm talking about Lost in Translation for the other uses of it, I'm not saying they got it wrong or anything. I'm simply pointing out there's a sort of range of meaning, from the very normal to being a bit different from that. So I don't repeat it in this time session, but when we get into the next chapter and Jesus says, I am the good shepherd, he does say, Ego Eimi, ho kalos poimen, and you would never ever normally say that. You'd normally say, poimen kalos Eimi, with no ego. So it obviously does mean something special most of the time when Jesus uses it, but this is just a little reminder that it is actually a normal phrase in certain circumstances. Okay, that's the least exciting thing we're doing today, so let's move straight on. Jack, would you like to read the next bit? I'll stop you when I want.
An interesting and painful little word crops up in both of these month's chapters. Some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, for he does not observe the Sabbath. But others said, how can a man who is a sinner perform such signs? And they were divided. Again, Jews were divided because of these words. The Greek word is schism, and it occurs in just two other places in the New Testament. First is in the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus talks of a new patch tearing an old piece of clothing when it shrinks. And the second is Paul's first letter to the church at Corinth, which was being divided by false teaching.
Okay, again, it's nothing very surprising, and it's not a wrong translation. Quite a lot of what they're doing today, I'm just pointing out things that you wouldn't know in such detail if it weren't for the Greek. That's not to say it's been translated wrong. It's translated perfectly correctly, because it means to divide. But we get used to the idea of schism, don't we? I suppose in a historical sense, perhaps, as being something really quite sort of significant and specific. And it tends nowadays to mean divisions within the church. So the Great Schism was in approximately 1000 AD. Beulah will know the precise date, not because she remembers it personally, I think, but because... it's when the Eastern and Western Christians divided finally, which sort of mirrored the division of the Roman Empire into East and West with Roman to Byzantium. But it was about, well, around about coming on towards 1000 AD when the church officially divided into what we now think of as Catholic with a big C and Orthodox with a big O. But other schismatics, you know, you've heard the word and schisms and things. It's just a rather horrid little word, isn't it?
The Orthodox Church is schismatic but not heretical.
Yes.
You, I think, are heretical and probably
not schismatic. Not fully schismatic.
No,
you're quite right, yes. Mm-hmm. That's right. So us Anglicans are wrong, but we're still in partial fellowship. Yes. Whereas the Orthodox are right but not in fellowship, something like that.
A difference between were divided and schism. The were divided means that they were, it means something temporary. It doesn't seem so axe chop as schism, which is going to be written into all the...
Yes. I mean, what's so ironic and sad, isn't it, is the teaching of Jesus is that the great division between those who responded to him and those who didn't. And somehow we've carried over into the body of those who respond to Jesus sort of further divisions and subdivisions, which is so sad. And already in 1 Corinthians you find that. Paul uses the word three times, I think, in 1 Corinthians, which has plagued a division. It's a very divided church. And Paul is really quite het up about that. But the only way Jesus ever used the word, or here John, in fact, but I mean Jesus himself used it only in the Sermon on the Mount. If you put a new patch on old clothing, the stitching will tear when you wash it because it's going to shrink. And that's a very vivid image of how you've got something new. It's very hard for an old religion to contain it.
At least Jesus, he has other sheep I have.
Yes, which were in chapter 10, which we're coming to today. Yeah, we are. Let's save that one up, because I wasn't going to talk about that bit, but as you mention it, when we get there, I will. Yes.
Is there another schism at some point where, I don't think it was Peter and Paul at some point, but something to do with the basis then of the Arab, of a Muslim religion at some point?
I guess to begin with, all new religions look like a schism from the old one. That Christianity looked like a subset of Judaism to start with, and I suppose that most Muslims to begin with are sort of wonky Christians. You know, it's.
So there was at some point.
Yeah.
And in the New Testament church, amongst the apostles, Peter, Paul, there was big divergence at times, but they seemed to be able to sort it out without sort of going there. Is it Peter? Paul says, I opposed Peter to the face.
Yes, to his face, yes, that's right. Yeah. On a matter of principle to do with receiving the Gentiles fully into the church.
And I picked this up in an art history lecture at the time, that there was this sort of schism. What they were basing it on, I don't know, because it wasn't a religious thing. We were looking at art.
Well, I mean, technically, the word schism simply means division. It's a Greek word meaning division. It's the usual Greek word for division. But it's become used technically in a historical sense. You're quite right, in an art sense, I think. They've been talking about the Eastern iconoclasts and so on, probably there, and things like that, I suspect. Okay. But, I mean, there'll probably be other uses of it.
Schism sounds more final.
It's one of those horrid-sounding words.
It sounds, doesn't it?
Yes. And it feels it's got undertones of sort of people forfeiting their salvation, you know, partly because of the heavy-handed teaching of the church at times, you know, that if you're not sort of on board of the true believers, then you're for it. So it's got a heavy-sounded sort of word, like heretic, you know. And it's probably been freighted, I think, with persecution and all sorts down the years. It's become, to feel to me at least, quite an ugly word.
Is it used in the Reformation?
Well, yes, they did use the word schismatic. Again, Bueller will tell us what the Latin is. I think they just carried across in the Greek and used schismatus or something. But I forget. And they used to use the word heretic, certainly, hereticus, which is a Greek word. Yeah. Did we look at heretic last time, or did I do it with somebody else? It literally means the person who makes up his own mind about something, or her own mind, which is thought to be a great sin. In those days.
We haven't covered it.
No, well, in that case, I'll tell you. Heretic comes from the Greek word hario, which means I choose. And the essence of a heretic is they choose what to believe rather than doing what the authorities say, which nowadays is probably seen as a virtue, but in the old days was seen as a vice.
Yes, I mean, in Tudor days, one minute you were orthodox and the next minute you were a heretic.
Well, I mean,
or vice versa.
I mean,
very strange.
To live through those times, through Henry, Edward, Mary, Elizabeth. You could be sort of killed each time for a different reason without changing your mind about anything. It's a horrid time.
And it's a wonderful book, The Voices of Morbius.
Yes, indeed. Which does a fine detail, doesn't it, of a particular village. It really gets into the records and pulls out what's going on in this Tudor village.
And the poor parish priest who has to get up before all his parishioners, which he's very fond of, isn't he? Mm. And say, everything I've taught you for the last 20 years
is wrong. Yes, that's right. Yes. Yes. And then say the same thing again 10 years later. Mm. Yes.
On a more positive note, I'm actually quite encouraged by this, that we tend to, well, in the circles from which I come, the Pharisees and the Jewish leaders are typically presented as a negative lot. And whatever Jesus said, they just said, we're again that. Whereas here, you get that sense that some of them are saying, hang on a minute, has this man really got something here? Mm. You know, yeah. And I know we've grown up with this way of looking things. Perhaps we've got it wrong.
Well, you see, I don't think anyone really knows for certain what proportion of the Jewish hearers of Christ in the early years became Christians. You know, was it a tenth? Was it nine tenths? I mean, it's actually very hard to work out what proportion. I've never seen it done. There must be some research of those who were Jews in naught AD were Christians in 100 AD, so to speak. Not that there ever was a naught AD, was there? It went straight from 1 BC to 1 AD. But, I mean, you know, there must be some research. It's quite an interesting question. I think I'm rather vague.
I would differentiate between the person in the synagogue pew, if there was such a thing,
yeah,
and the leaders thereof.
Oh, yes.
You know, and it's the leaders thereof that we're reading about here who were saying,
well, of course,
perhaps there's a bit more to this than we thought.
They had most to lose, didn't they? That's always the way.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Jackie, just round it off, will you, with that next bit, which really just comes to what you said, although it has come.
Although it has come to refer to the said divisions between Christians of different opinions, starting within a few years of Jesus' death, the word schism originally referred to the much greater division between those who believed in Jesus and those who didn't.
Yeah, we've just been talking about that. Okay, it's not very important, that. I mean, it's not a mistranslation. It's just pointing out that the Greek word for division is schism. So this is where these words come from. Let's move on a bit, shall we? So, Val, would you do number three?
One of the Greek words used to determine the date of John's Gospel is found in this chapter. The Jews had already agreed that anyone who confessed Jesus to be the Messiah would be put out of the synagogue. The Jews...
Lie down. Excommunicate.
Thank you. The Jews excommunicated Christians, sorry, pronounced him to be a Akos synagogues,
Gobos. One of those sort of things, anyway. Yep.
Is generally dated to the 12th or the 18th benedictions against the heretics in 85 to 90 AD.
This bit's rather fun, so read on.
For the renegades, let there be no hope, and may the arrogant kingdom soon be rooted out in our days, and the Nazarenes perish as in a moment, and be blotted out from the book of life.
Yeah, the Jewish curse on Christians, round about 85 AD. The technical term, aposynagogos, read on.
Thank you. Because it ties in John's Gospel and nowhere else in the New Testament. And it is seen by many as an indication that this part of the Gospel, at least, must date from no earlier than the last decade of the first century.
OK, it's a little bit technical, that, but it might interest you. That it was in the second half of the ninth decade of the first century, in 85 to 90 AD, that they brought out this particular 12th benediction. Doesn't sound like a benediction, but it ends with... Yes, but it ends with, blessed be God, who reserves his people from heresy or something, you know. Which is basically declaring them, it's like a fatwa or something, whatever the word is in Islam, declaring them to be beyond the pale. That's the sort of first official thing we find. And therefore a number of people, because aposynagogos looks like a fairly technical word, apo means out of, and synagogos means out of the synagogue. It's thought to be a reflection of that particular edict. Some of us don't necessarily agree with that, mind you. But I think probably a majority of scholars on John's Gospel would suggest that that's a pretty strong indication that it's late. They may be right.
Did the Jews condemned to death for...
Yes. Yes. They didn't have the power to condemn to death, which is why they had to hand Jesus over to the Romans to crucify him. At 85 AD, they didn't have any power anywhere because they'd all been dispersed from Judea.
But they were going to stone the woman.
Yes, they were. That was technically illegal. They were. They had a license for executing under authority. They couldn't take the initiative in it. And certainly they're going to stone it. There's probably as much a lynching as an official thing, that. Like in the next chapter when they try to stone Jesus. We don't do that bit, actually, but they try and stone Jesus in chapter 10. It's spontaneous. It's very ugly stuff, isn't it? And you see it. You see it, today. And we really mustn't just think you only see it in other religions. There's a lot of horrid stuff amongst Christians, I think, being very beastly to people who they disagree with. But not in polite middle-class Anglican circles. We're just more subtle, aren't we? My opinion is that it doesn't... that you haven't got to think that. In other words, if John is as late as some people say, then it wasn't written primarily to Jews, probably. In which case, what's the problem of being jacked up a synagogue? You don't belong to it already. So the whole thing is a bit of a peculiar argument. And I don't agree anyway that aposynagogos necessarily is a technical term, referring to that benediction. It's a very normal sort of word, even if you don't find it elsewhere in the New Testament. And although you don't find the word elsewhere in the New Testament, you do find Jesus in the Synoptic Gospels, which are thought to be a bit earlier, talking about being expelled from synagogues. It's not using the jargon. So I think some people have put too much weight on it, but it is an example. You get indications in John of earliness, you get indications in John of lateness, and this is one of the indications of lateness, basically.
I'm very sorry. Could you go a little bit slower?
Yeah, I will. I will. I'm saying it's a technical...
I'm fascinated by what's coming out of...
Yeah, I'm saying it's a technical term that we've got here, or it looks like a technical term.
Yeah.
And some would therefore argue it must reflect a later date in which there was a technical process for excommunicating,
yeah.
Not just a general process of chucking out people you got fed up with. Because you could do that. There were three levels of expulsion from the synagogue, a bit like from school, really, you know, being sent home for the afternoon, so to speak, or being banned for 3 months, or being banned for life and being put under a ban of not belonging to the people of God. And there were different levels of it all. The thing's quite technical, I don't know a great deal about it. But this, the benediction, is putting Christians in the last category of being excluded from the people of God, namely the Jewish people. Should we move on? There's more good stuff coming, so should we just keep moving? And we can slow down on things we want to talk more about. And the next one isn't a very big one either. I'm sorry about this. There's more over the page, actually. Liz, it's your turn, please.
There's a very interesting little piece of dialogue towards the end of this chapter. When Jesus found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" He answered, "And who is he, sir? Tell me so that I may believe in him." Jesus said to him, "You've seen him, and the one speaking with you is he." He said, "Lord, I believe," and he worshipped him. Carry on.
Please.
The same word, sir and lord, in these verses translate just one Greek word, kyrie. It's a neat example of how a little word can carry a range of meaning from the everyday to the theologically profound.
Yeah. It's also a good example of the task of the translator. I guess different versions will do that in different ways. I think they've got it. This is I'm always using the NRSV. It's the approved or the most approved version for Church of England churches. It's the one that you'll hear read in church on Sunday unless the reader has chosen to use a different version, which is quite often in some of our churches. So I think they do it well. I think they've got the shift in meaning very well there, but it is the same word.
In the NRSV, they've actually got footnotes that basically say this is the same word, although they put sir and lord.
But they're good.
Was reading it this morning in NRSV.
Excellent.
I've got everything but here.
Right. Yeah. Well done for you doing your homework. As you know, I like the translate, the NRSV. I'm quite pleased they've adopted that one as their main one. Kyrie, you thought that, of course, as in Kyrie eleison, don't you? Lord, have mercy. Yeah.
quite a lot of hair.
Hair in German. Yes.
Means Lord and
yes. Sister. So we use hair of God, hair of mine God, and that sort of thing.
No.
Yes, her God, isn't it?
And it's French is the same. Monsieur.
Yes.
Which is quite medieval.
Yes, actually. Yes, my sir, my lord, yes.
Mm. Yes.
Mm.
English doesn't do it quite so well.
Well,
that's master, though.
I suppose you could address yes. Mickey St. Aldwyn as Lord if you were in the mood and wanted to get up his nose.
So, that's the problem.
My Lord.
My Lord, yes.
Yes.
Well,
which
used
is
to
the correct form of address to him.
Mm-hmm. Who was that dreadful bishop, Archbishop? Fisher, wasn't it? Do you remember Fisher? Mm-hmm. Hadn't he been headmaster of somewhere? And
Geoffrey Fisher.
Geoffrey Fisher, yes. His first interview with the press. Yes?
He did tick them off. And
he was appalling from the word go, old Fisher, wasn't he? Was he head teacher, headmaster of Repton or something before he became Archbishop? Just awful. But anyhow, one of them said to him, how should I address you, Archbishop? And he said, oh, call me my Lord, same as God. And that which didn't go down at all well with the press. But it was very in character, I think.
He should have been struck down.
He should. Awful.
He could have said it flippantly.
Well, I think he probably did say it sort of flippantly, but even so, it's very dodgy territory to verge on when you're trying. You should try and impress him with your humility.
First rule of talking to journalists, never be flippant.
Yes.
Well, yes, don't appear arrogant, because they hate it, don't they?
Yes, I'm quite sure he didn't mean it just like, I mean, but he clearly, it did not go down well. Again, nothing profound in one sense here, but just a reminder of the translator's task. Words with range of meaning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of them, like Pistuo, like Ego Amy, like so many of them. You pay your money and takes your choice.
Before we move on...
Yes, please.
Chapter 10.
Let's do chapter 9 any more you wish.
No, I was just going to say I actually love chapter 9 because it's a great example, I think, of people who've... without wishing to spiritualize it too much, have had an experience of God, an encounter with God, with Jesus in their lives, and all sorts of people come up to them and say, well, what about this, and how about this, and surely you... And they just say, I don't know. All I know is that once I was blind and now I can see. End of. I don't know how it worked. That was it.
Who he is.
His parents who said we won't ask him.
Yeah. We don't know. Just go and ask him.
And he starts to lose patience with the Pharisees, doesn't he? He says, you seem very interested in this guy. Do you want to become his disciples as well? He really winds them up. Yeah. Yeah, he gives them. He holds his own with them.
He's quite astute, I think, in that, really.
Yes. He is, and he's not cowed by them, is he?
Yeah.
He answers back. Yeah. I think so would I if I'd just been healed like that. You know, you just feel, well, stuff you. You're trying to do down the chap who did this. Yeah.
And, of course, we've also got that little phrase at the beginning where there's the bit about, well, who sinned then?
Yes.
And Jesus makes it very clear this is not about personal sin and localized sin at all.
Yes, that he sinned or did his parents,
yes.
That he's been born blind.
Yeah.
And when the Pharisees are having a hard time, they obviously hold to that old-fashioned view. They hadn't believed Jesus or hadn't heard him say that because they said you were born in sin and here you are trying to lecture us. And that's basically they're saying you must be a sinner because you've had all this trouble in your life. So the penny hasn't dropped for them. That comes towards the end of the chapter.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus is very strong on these things. Do you remember that they went to him and said, or did he initiate the subject, about when the tower in Siloam fell on various people and killed them?
Yeah.
It's not a very well-known little passage, so Mike, of course, knows it. Jesus just refers to it almost in passing, doesn't he? He's saying, look... Suffering is not a consequence of sin, or is not a proof that you are a sinner, that innocent people suffer. And I think he uses, rather than disciples, he uses the example of the tower that fell down in Siloam, which we don't otherwise know about, and killed people. as an example of how quite genuinely innocent people suffer. But to this very day, many, many people think that there's a link. They're fatalists in that sense.
Well, I mean, they also think it the other way around, don't they? That somehow it's God's job to protect them from suffering and illness, and if something bad happens to a member of their family, it can shake their faith, which you do understand, because obviously it is a really difficult when horrid things happen.
Yes.
I know three or four people who've wandered far from the faith because of family bereavements. But equally, I know people who've been brought back to God because of family bereavements. So there's a great mystery sometimes here, isn't there?
It's a great mystery. I sometimes think it's almost just as a need to cope by psychological change, because you're absolutely right, the same things that bring some people to faith cause other people to lose their faith. It's as though somehow one's previous sort of worldview is insufficient to contain what has happened, so you alter the worldview. I don't mean at a conscious level. So that's, you know, people do become Christians who weren't, I mean, in terms of what they believe, and people give up church involvement or whatever who were. It feels to me as though your previous way of seeing the universe can't contain what has happened. Mm-hmm. So it gets altered.
And I think one of the things I've learned over the years is not to try and put things in tidy little boxes, because this whole concept of sin and evil and suffering and so on, we get glimpses, but we really don't know. And if we try to say to people, ah, well, it's because X, Y, Z, we can very quickly get ourselves into awful tangles.
Well, that is the problem with what you were saying, because the people who go away from their faith, their fulcrum of their faith is that they believe God is in charge of everything that happens. Mm. People who come back to faith, it's because they feel that God helps them through suffering, that he's there with his love to bring them through. So it's two different aspects. Mm. That's categorising.
No, it's a good summary.
No, it's good.
It's actually a very good summary. It's a very good summary.
And yes, I mean, I believe that God's in charge, but I'm still saying, why? Sometimes.
Yeah, but to say God's in charge, that can vary from, I mean, this was a debate, a couple of you there, weren't it? Well, not a debate, it was mentioned, wasn't it, at your Julian meeting I came to. One member was saying she believed that God gave her parking spaces when she prayed for them. And another member was saying quite specifically she believed the exact opposite of that. So, I mean, and I guess you have a view, and I'm not in any sense belittling the view, I think it's admirable that God gives you a parking space and you pray for one, then it must be particularly hard to cope with when something appalling happens and you pray for it to be changed and it doesn't. Because you imagine
how you relate the parking space one, avalanches, earthquakes.
Well, yes, that's part of the thing, isn't it? Perhaps God is so busy giving out parking spaces he can't look after people in other countries. We all have those feelings about that. But then we all remember about Jesus teaching simplicity in faith and, you know, no sparrow falls except the Father allows it sort of thing, and commending that sort of level of trust as an example of dependency.
I'm going to have to say this. I think my faith must be extremely simple, because I neither went away nor went back to my faith. It was just there.
No, great, good for
20
you.
Years of illness.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's just a very strong faith.
I feel it is. And yeah. I was helped through it and... Yeah.
Well, thank you for saying that, Jackie, because a lot of us have seen your faith as a great example to us.
Mm.
Yes, really. I'm not just saying that. I really mean that. Mm.
Well, I think I said I got my faith at around the age of 10, really, and it's...
No, that's not simple in any wrong sense. It's simple in the right sense.
No, but I'm absolutely focused, a bit like, you know, the blind man who could then see.
Yeah, yeah.
Why? It is.
That's wonderful.
And Margaret is exactly the same. So yeah. We're a good counterbalance to each other. Whereas I'm constantly and agonising, she just says, well, I just believe.
Yeah.
I feel the same as you, Jackie.
Do you? Yeah.
Yes.
Mm. You, I don't know where it was said, whether it was in one of these groups. I mean, people blame God for an aeroplane crashing, but God can't be expected to keep the wings up or the engine going on a plane. It's just not connected at all, is it? It's totally different. I just believe that God is there. In whatever happens, God is there at some point. In a huge disaster, God will be there with the people helping the people. Yes, that's it. He's there with the people helping.
And I become almost impatient sometimes with those who use third-party suffering as a reason for not believing themselves. You know, they say, how can you believe in God when this happens?
Yeah.
And I tend to say, well, talk to the people there. Yeah. Because actually, very often you do that, you find that a much higher proportion of those believe in God than people looking on.
Mm-hmm.
I guess at a human level it can almost be worse. I mean, it's not equivalent, but it can almost be worse to see a loved one suffer than to suffer yourself. Mm. And in that sense, you need to say to the person involved in it, well, you know, what's happening for you? And time and again, like with these poor nations, we see them being oppressed or starving or whatever, and you find many, many, many of them are trusting and even grateful to God throughout it.
Mm. What about the theory that Satan is in charge? This is the right
gospel in which to raise that question. Have we done dualism yet in John's gospel? Have we done that?
Did I refer to it? You say that we're going to cover it at some point.
Oh, I must make sure we do then.
Devil and evil.
Oh, well, which chapter should we find that in then, Mark?
Well, you,
like, because I haven't found it yet.
You mentioned it in passing and then said, oh, we'll cover that later.
Yes, that's very interesting.
Later, as in another chapter. Well, I can't remember which chapter it would come up.
Because it would come up in the Synoptics, because it comes up in the Lord's Prayer. But the Lord's Prayer isn't in John, is it? So, it's perhaps we're not going to find it, we should do it anyway.
I think we should.
Will you just for a moment talk amongst yourselves? I will look up whether Paneros comes in John's Gospel. And if it doesn't, we'll have 5 minutes on it now. And if it does, we'll do it when it crops up.
Probably
in the doldrums in the middle. You choose to ignore.
Well, I'm often called the devil's advocate, so.
Otherwise known as a stirpot.
No,
only
to
provoke. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's
more interesting. You sometimes find people slipping into that mode as though it's a finely balanced scale between good and evil.
Because Christ said he had overcome.
Yes.
It comes next time.
Oh.
Chapter 17, verse 15. In a Teresa's altus ecter poneru. Take two poneru. And that's an ideal verse for discussing it. So come next time. Because two poneru could be masculine or neuter. It could be evil or it could be the devil. So,
you say it in English, that phrase.
Yes, so that it's part of the high priestly prayer, so that you may shield them and guard them from evil, or from the evil one. Mm. Which is rather like a sort of commentary on the Lord's Prayer, in fact. Mm. Often John doesn't include things that are in the Synoptics, but has sideways swipes at them. He doesn't have the Last Supper, the institution of communion, in John's Gospel, but he has the I am the bread of life teaching instead. So, I mean, very often things that sort of come straight in the Synoptics, you get a sort of commentary on it, John, instead. So the High Priestly Prayer, chapter 17, which is the only chapter I think we're doing as one chapter, and not two, in these sessions.
Chapter
17. We will find that question, Jane, and ask it again. Ask it again. And we'll talk about Johannine dualism, which overlaps with Gnostics, and it overlaps with Dead Sea Scrolls, and it's all very fashionable. Oh, thank you for that reminder. Well, that's helpful, because it means when it crops up next time, I'll remember to highlight it. Should we move on to I'm the Good Shepherd? Uh-uh. Right, a mini thing first. Jane, could you read the mini thing?
I am the Good Shepherd.
Yes, and read on to the end of section one.
Again, there are plenty of interesting details in the passage. John never uses the word parable, though it occurs literally dozens of times in the Synoptic Gospels. Instead, he just occasionally uses the word
paroimia.
Jesus used this figure of speech with them, but they did not understand what he was saying to them. The word means proverb, and was the usual word for the Jewish method in the Old Testament and by the rabbis of teaching through pithy sayings.
Okay, there's a word in the Old Testament called mashal, which is proverbs. So the book of Proverbs is mashalim. And it's a very recognised Jewish way of talking. You can imagine them doing it, sort of these rabbis with beards shrugging and sort of saying pithy things. They love to use aphorisms or whatever to sort of teach. And, you know, the best rabbis like Oscar Wilde were famous for sort of clever things they'd said, sort of Jewish one-liners. And it's a whole sort of recognised way of teaching, which was very popular. And the word in Greek for that is paroimia, which isn't used, I don't think, by the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark and Luke. They use parabole a great deal. Very often the word that they use, John uses a different word. They use miracle, and John never uses that word. He uses the word sign. And quite often John will use a more Jewish word for it all. But he seems to be from a tradition very largely untouched by the other gospel writers. That's to say, John or whoever wrote his gospel probably had no contact with Matthew, Mark and Luke's writings. They did their own thing entirely. Untouched by it. And so they didn't pick up some of the jargon that was becoming current in the church in other parts of the Mediterranean. That's the impression I get. So it's not a very important thing there. It's just another example of how John has a different swipe at things from synoptics, and perhaps an example of how John, more than some people sometimes recognise, has got quite Jewish roots, which again I think is an argument to a certain extent for its earliness, but that's less certain. Okay, shall we move on to something slightly more important? Well, the next one's good. So, would you please? Who's next? Sue.
Perhaps the most important phrase in this chapter, to be obscured if not lost in translation, comes in its most famous verses. I am the good shepherd. Greek has two quite different words for good, kalos and agathos. The second of these, agathos, means morally good and is only rarely applied to particular people. Even Jesus challenged the questioner who described him as agathos. Kalos, on the other hand, which is the word used here, literally means beautiful. It has a sense more of ideal or admirable. I am the model.
Okay, thank you there. Yeah, lots one could say here, so perhaps we shall say some of it. Kalos, meaning good, is a very classical Greek idea. You know, you get these sort of idealised statues, don't you? A sort of handsome young men with no clothes on. That they saw a direct link, the classical Greeks, between physical beauty and moral stature. You know, they'd never elect an ugly person. The Americans are a bit like this too, to a high office. Well, actually, Trump's pretty ugly, isn't he? But there was something about it that was seen as being not just sort of rather nice to rest the eyes upon, but quite genuinely virtuous. To be good looking, the whole sort of they prize going to the gym literally, and that sort of thing. And that's a very classical background, which gives us the word kalos, which is their usual word for good. The Greeks talk about kalos much more than anything else. They want to know, is a politician kalos? Not as the agathos. He could be having affairs and swindling people all he chose, but was he a sort of upstanding chap, is what they wanted to know. And kalos would describe that. Agathos is much more of a moral word. It's used a great deal in the New Testament of things. You know, good speech, a good deed. Very, very rarely of people. And as I say, when somebody called Jesus agathos, I did this in a sermon a couple of weeks ago, didn't I? Mm. When Jesus actually challenged him and said, stop smarming me. You know, what are you trying to achieve?
That was a good teacher, isn't it?
Yes, good teacher. What must you inherit eternal life? Agathos teacher. And Jesus didn't accept that of him. He might have been technically correct, but it's not how you normally talk to people. So just two or three people in the New Testament are called agathos. And I think it's a high accolade when they are.
So is that in Mark when the rich man asking.
Yes. Mm. What must I do to inherit eternal life? Exactly so. Last week's gospel reading. Right. 8 days ago.
Good teacher.
Agatha Didaskale, good teacher. Yeah. And so I'm the good shepherd. It means something a bit different. Had you come across that distinction before between you? Liz, you're more of a classicist than a New Testament Greek person. Do you have any opinions about it?
Nothing to add to what you're saying from the Greek. I mean, it's led to me thinking about other things about the ideal.
Yeah. Plato.
Philosophical.
Yes, Plato.
Yes, Plato had this sort of theory, didn't he, that everything derives its meaning because there is somewhere out there a lot of ideal qualities, which is how we are to understand the sort of shadowy aspects that we have in this world. But I don't think that's actually what's going on here.
No, but I mean, the word ideal is, I'm not sure if Plato uses kalos for it, I can't remember. But, well, there's another thing we could talk about sometime, which I'll particularly want to now. To what extent Platonism affects John's gospel? It doesn't affect the others. I said it was a very Jewish gospel, but it's also a very philosophically based one, influenced by a whole variety of things. And Gnosticism, certainly, which John was aware of, possibly slightly caught up in and possibly slightly combating. Gnosticism as a sort of sect, really, of Christianity, was very Greek-derived, and that was quite Platonic.
But is it taking you into the metaphysical, really, when applying Agathos to the shepherd, rather than the practical nature of just being a...
Well, the shepherd is kalos, the shepherd is ideal.
Yes.
There's a fascinating passage, it's in the Midrash, which is the Hebrew commentary on the Old Testament, which describes David, who is the ideal sort of proto-Jesus almost, as the beautiful shepherd. Using the Greek word that I've forgotten from, the Hebrew word that I've forgotten for a moment, for beautiful. And so I don't know if Jesus knew that expression or if his hearers did. Or if they literally meant he was beautiful, because David is reputed to be very handsome.
Yes, he's sort of saying, and I don't mean that it's looking after the sheep, I mean that this is something much more mystical.
Yes.
It's interesting that you used the word metaphysical there, Jane, because it immediately made me think that Tom Wright, who writes extensively about the afterlife, life after life after death, says that much of our current thinking in the church about life after death owes more to Plato than it does to the New Testament.
Yes, yeah.
Christianity is, the only religion that actually goes to what is not physically beautiful,
yeah,
and sees beyond it.
Mm.
And in fact, the crucifixion is what it's all about.
Yes, yes. I mean, that's almost anti-beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah.
And there was no beauty in him that we could do. Yes.
Yes, which is, I mean, that's the suffering servant, Isaiah,
yeah.
53.
And doesn't that tie up exactly with what John's drawn out here? That Jesus is saying, when the person came and said, good teacher, Jesus is actually saying, don't put me on a pedestal here. You know, I am the one sent from God. I am a teacher, yes, but I am not, do not view me in an incorrect way.
Lie down. What Jesus is saying here, well, I try and summarise, I think, in the last sentence of that paragraph. Where have I put it? I lost it.
You said
the best summary.
He's giving us an example to follow.
Yes, that Jesus is going to have something to follow. I think that catches the word.
Yes, yeah.
Look at me. This is what shepherds should look like. Or this is what leaders of people should look like. Or this is what whatever should look like. That I think is the main thrust of Kalos. Which is why I use the word model. It's not a word very often used now, perhaps, in that way. Anything more before we move on Kalos and Agathos? The people Agathos is used for, by the way, I think they're all very attractive people. I don't mean attractive physically. I mean their characters, I think, are terrific. Joseph of Arimathea, I think, was a good man. That was one who was. And was Barnabas one? I forget. There's just the literary two or three. I must look up who they are sometime. And Agathos is... it's one of the fruit of the Spirit. Do you remember in Galatians 5:22, the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, kindness, goodness. That's agathē, I think.
Right.
I'm almost certain that's agathē.
Did you say kindness?
Yes, kindness. Yeah, it's love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control.
What's the Greek word for kindness?
Is the one? Yes, indeed. I'm just trying to think. Is it helikia?
Agathos.
But kindness, which isn't kindness. Here, helikia. It's. I'm trying to think where you find that in the Gospels. Again, I can look it up in a minute. They're lovely words. In fact, I mean, lovely studies to do sometime is to do nine on the nine fruit of the Spirit. Much better for the church than doing the gifts of the Spirit, I think, personally. Perhaps we'll do that when we finish this. Well, we carry on about the Good Shepherd with item three. So, Beulah, are you okay over there? Can you do this?
Says twice that he is a good shepherd. First, because he gives his life for the sheep. And secondly, I am a good shepherd. I know my own, and my own know me. Just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father.
Thank you. Is that a read on?
Like many other languages, Greek has two words for I know.
Oida and gnosko.
I can't pronounce it, no. I've got a crease right through the middle.
Well, that's a good alibi. Oida and gnosko.
Thank you. For the French savoir and connaître. We met them both in a single verse in chapter 21 a few months ago. The word here, gnosko, means to know personally, to have a relationship with.
Yes, I don't know how many more years I'll be able to use a phrase like have a relationship with. It's becoming so much to do with actually you're a sexual partner of somebody nowadays, but our generation can still use the phrase. We met us in our second session, which you've probably forgotten, John 21, when Peter and Jesus are talking, you know, feed my sheep, that passage. And Peter says to Jesus at the end of it, when Jesus has really humbled him, Lord, you know everything, you know that I'm your friend. That's oida everything, gnosko, I'm your friend. And oida is to know in theory, gnosko is to know in practice. Well, it's savoir and connaître, really, or similar to those, at least. Connaître you can really only use of people, whereas gnosko you can use of things. But it means a practical experience of. I just think it's rather nice, that. What makes Jesus the Good Shepherd? He says the two things. The first thing that makes him the good Shepherd is that he dies for the sheep. The second thing is that he knows them personally. He bothers. He knows their names. And we get this... In some Christian circles, don't you? You get sort of talk of having a personal relationship with Jesus and things. Which I think is saying something quite important theologically, if slightly glutinously. Saccharine. The expression I find tricky now, partly because it's being coloured by how the next generation down use it, which means that you're going to bed with them. So it's a phrase that's shifting its meaning.
A lot of prayers start off with, Lord, what do I call you?
Oh, I was about to say, do they? I mean, sounds a good thing to say. But I don't know. How do we relate to this idea of knowing God personally? Does it sound lovely or true or peculiar or alarming?
I
just is. That's a good answer, Val. Good answer.
I think it's a healthy corrective to the just having fine ideas and opinions.
Hmm. Yes. It's not. That's right. It's to have a relationship with God, not to have a
an opinion
about God. To know God.
Well, it's not really up to us to have an opinion about God, is it?
That would be heretical. We were choosing what to think.
Well, no, I don't mean that. I mean it not from the point of view of heresy, but from the point of view of difference in status.
Yes.
That it's quite important for us, I think, to realise our the sort of medieval people might call our creatureliness.
Yes.
I think it depends how medieval your own spirit you are, because the word Lord has a...
oh, yes. A liege Lord.
Yes, my Lord. It's not... what's his name down the road?
No, it would be if I was his tenant.
Somebody who...
Mickey.
You pledge loyalty to.
Yes. You bend the knee to.
And
give him a tenth of your pigs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is the whole.
Yes, and fight for him in battle.
Yeah.
Yes.
And recruit people for him, actually.
You do. That's interesting.
They had to recruit so many knights too.
Jane.
My distinguishing of no is knowing when you define something and knowing when you're aware.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes. God, I'm aware, but I don't define.
Yes, another helpful distinction, thank you. And do you remember the collect I quoted last night at Quennington, but alluded to in the other sermons, because I was talking about whose service is perfect freedom. The first part of the phrase is, in knowledge of whom standeth our eternal life. To know God is to live forever. One of the best things Cranmer wrote, that collect.
Yes.
We almost never use it. Knowledge of whom standeth our eternal life, which means not that he knows us, but that we know him.
It's this idea of knowing. And let's not forget that knowing in the Old Testament, in the King James, has a very strong sexual connotation. But in the New Testament, the shorthand, and amongst many Christians, people talk about knowing God as having a relationship with God, not just knowing about God. Because isn't that the thrust? You know, we can call God Father in the daddy sense of Father, not the remote figure.
Sorry, you got stuck. You can't get out. You just keep them.
Sounds happy.
Oi. Devil or evil?
You can't get out. Go on then. Go on. Get up there.
That'll teach ya.
I should have to put him under there. And he comes through. Yes, I did check whether yadah, which means to know in the Old Testament, whether the sexual at times, Adam knew his wife and yes. She conceived and bore a son, whether that carried across into gonosko, and it never does.
Oh, it never does. Okay.
No, I just it interested me. Because there are certainly words that are that sort of deep, or at one end of their meaning have got that level of intimacy, which are used of us and God. Yeah.
But it's surely the whole thrust of Christianity and what Jesus said is God can be known, as in you can
yes.
you can relate to God and God can relate to you. It's not just book stuff.
Yes. Yes. And just sort of liturgy stuff. I mean, this is the huge thing. It's lovely. Val was it, or somebody, it probably was Val, just said, it just is, or something.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's exactly the thing that just isn't for most people. That if you said to people, what is a Christian, or something, none of them would ever say somebody who knows God. They'd talk about what we believed or what we did. It would never occur to them to define us in terms of relationship, I don't think, that God is real to us, or more than that, you know, that we actually... Though, as we would say, that they wouldn't, that we know God, or yes, we know God.
Beulah picked this up just now. I mean, the sort of great creedal thing in the New Testament is, can you say Jesus is Lord?
Yes.
With all that,
that implies.
Acknowledging someone is Lord to you means.
Mm.
If you can say that, that's it.
It's remedy generating Christianity into being able to tick boxes. The Athanasian Creed is an appalling thing, that unless you can you believe the incredible and understand the incomprehensible, then you are surely damned, is more or less how it starts. It's entirely a mental operation. I mean, most creeds feel like that. They're not supposed to be, but I'm getting more fed up with saying the creed, not because I don't believe it, but because I don't think it works liturgically, because we're supposed to be expressing faith and we're expressing belief. At the heart of it is the knowing, isn't this? It's a very important bit of what we're looking at. Let's move on, though, because we haven't got all afternoon. Number four. Come on, this is interesting, I think. Mike, let's skip over me. I talk too much anyway. Two little word plays.
Two little word plays are hidden in the second half of the chapter. I have other sheep that do not belong to this fold. I must bring them also, and they will listen to my voice. So there will be one flock, one shepherd. The words flock and shepherd,
this will test you,
are poimeni and poimen, sheepherd and shepherd. The unity of Christians is based on the fact that for all our different opinions, we follow one shepherd.
Yes, Beulah mentioned this right at the beginning, and I told her to wait until we got there. You may remember, three quarters of an hour ago, that this is the verse that you mentioned for some reason. I forget why you mentioned it.
Well, I've got...
No, I spotted you down, but here it is. Here's your verse.
We were talking about the schism between the Orthodox and the Catholics,
weren't we? Right, very likely. Yes. This isn't very important, but I think it's fine. I think Jesus is making a point. He's just using a wordplay to illustrate the closeness, the sort of similarity, that there is one flock because there's one shepherd. It is almost the whole point. The two are sort of integral.
Oh, yeah, yes, it was. When he said somewhere, I have other sheep.
Indeed, onto this fold, yes. So if the fold is the Catholic Church, there are others in the Church of England who are in the same flock, but in a different fold. Pushing the analogy.
I've often heard it said that what Jesus is referring to here is that he's looking ahead beyond Judaism.
To the Gentiles.
To the Gentiles, yes.
I think he is.
Yeah.
And he said again, it says... You know, I'm not sent to the Gentiles, but to the scattered children of Israel.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, but I think the church has historically interpreted, as Mike did it, this is part of one of the verses that's justified in the early days, the extension of the mission to the Gentiles. And, you know, what's it mean in our day? If this were a Bible study rather than a sort of language study, we'd talk more about that, you know, that who else, you know, they're not in our flock, they're in our fold, rather. We don't see them in Quellington Church on a Sunday evening, but are there perhaps many members of the flock? Now, of course, I mean, in some ways, it's a matter of opinion how we answer that question, but it's a question that we need to be aware of and not limited to the visible.
I think one of the problems is that you can't hit on a liturgy that pleases, that we could just have on Sunday mornings one liturgy.
Yep.
Because, I there are the happy clappers, and there are us, and there's you, and there are little minute differences, and people get really worked up about it.
What's very heartening, I think, in the last few decades is how you can't always tell whether you're in an Anglican communion or a Roman Catholic mass. You have to look for small...
When you're at Vantage.
Well, yes.
She said tersely.
Or various places, certainly. Or
I used to go there.
Or Trinity Cheltenham. So, I mean, yes, there are various places. I mean, certainly at either end of the spectrum in both churches, you can tell they're not the same. But actually, the great bulk of people, you've got to be quite clued up nowadays, quite sophisticated, to know whether you're in Fairford Parish Church in St Mary's, or if you're in St Nicholas, whatever your Catholic one is, St Andrew's,
St Thomas.
I knew it was something. So yes, actually, you know, an unsophisticated or not very experienced person wouldn't quickly spot which it was, and that's good. So we're converging, I think, in terms of liturgy. Well, we're converging in the middle, and those wings are getting further away, aren't they? It's a hard process. But, yeah, it's a flock, not a fold. One reading only, one manuscript only, has fold, not flock, and it's thought to be simply a misprint, as it were. OK, the other wordplay, if you would, please, Jackie.
The other wordplay has a darker tone. Jesus said, "I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep." The Jews gathered around him and said to him, "How long will you keep us in suspense? If you are the Messiah, tell us plainly." The phrase translated, "keep us in suspense," is a rare idiom. We're not even quite sure what it means. The modern Greek equivalent means to make us angry, to get up someone's nose. Literally, it translates as to take away our life. So the Jews are actually saying, "Come on, you keep talking about giving up your life. You're starting to take away ours."
Yes. I felt rather pleased with myself when I discovered this, I have to confess, and thought, I've discovered something new. But then I went and looked it up in the usual places and found that Archbishop Temple had made the same point in his readings in John's Gospel, which meant that all
the... So was this the Archbishop Temple of whom we spoke?
No. Archbishop Temple is a great archbishop, unlike Geoffrey Fisher.
Fisher, sorry.
Which means that all the other commentaries I'd read had known this idea, because they'd have read Temple as well, and decided it either wasn't true or wasn't important, so I felt very chastened at that point. But I think it's interesting. And I think John is sophisticated enough to be aware of what he's doing, using these phrases just a few verses apart, that Jesus is talking about laying down his life, and they almost sort of sneer at him, I think, saying, "Look, you know, going on about this stuff, you're taking away ours now, just get to the point." Anyhow, I just tell you that because I noticed.
Can you just expand on what you've said here about "you're starting to take away ours"?
Well, that's what the phrase "keep us in suspense" literally means.
Well, what were they getting at there, or what do you think they were getting at? Their livelihood?
No.
Their whole belief system?
No. They didn't mean it literally at all. It's like getting up a nose. It's worth saying, how big was a nose to fit inside it? It's purely an idiom.
Oh, I see.
It's purely an idiom, but I think
annoying us.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think, actually, it probably does. That doesn't mean "keep us in suspense." I think it means getting up our nose.
Yeah.
Because that's what the modern Greek saying means.
Could it be like you're wasting our time?
You could be all sorts of things. Yes, that's right. I've got better things to do than listen to this stuff. Yes,
yeah.
It take away our life. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Yes.
Stop messing about. Cut to the.
Yes.
Yeah. But you see, this.
What are you really saying?
But it's echoing what Jesus was saying earlier, which is interesting. And I think it's a deliberate echo. I think there's a sneer in it.
Right.
But I may be wrong. And I'm just pointing out stuff that's hidden, possibly, in the Greek.
Mm.
That's not, again, not... I've told you lots of unimportant things this time, haven't I? So let's finish with something terribly important, but totally baffling, with Val.
Our last verse has had more books written about it and arguments held over it than almost any other verse in the Bible. "The Father and I are one." We could spend the next month discussing that, and we can spend the next few minutes doing so if you like. My only contribution at this stage is to remind you of John 14:28, "The Father is greater than I am," and the fact that "one" in the verse above is neuter, not masculine. Hen, not he is.
Yes, heis. Hen, not heis. Well, it's a bit of Greek there. This is absolutely the heart of all the early Christian debates about the Trinity, basically. But really, I can hardly bear. Yeah, I don't want to go into these great debates about the Trinity, but we can have a bit of a bash at it if we want, or Bueller can tell us what the correct answer is, if you like. So you can tell us, you could, the doctrine of the Trinity, you can solve it for us if you wish.
The first church I was ordained to, I was a curate in, was Holy Trinity, Coventry. and their badge was a three-leafed clover, or something like a three-leafed clover. It wasn't quite.
Yes. And you've got the old analogies, like it's not 1 + 1 + 1, but 1 × 1 × 1, haven't you?
Yes.
That's brilliant.
Yes. Yes, I've decided I'm a modalist, and if I lived a few centuries ago, I'd have been burnt, but I'm glad I don't.
Monophysite.
Yeah, yes, not a monophysite, yes.
How
precise
is
that one, that is? That's, monophysite means one nature only, that Jesus had only the nature of God. He's only pretending to be human. Well, actually, that's docetism, which is a bit different. There's lots of these. Sabellianism, you name it, it's terribly...
The heresies were actually only... overweighting one side of the proposition, weren't they? Jesus is God and man, and he is both. He is, but if you said he was more God than man, or he was more man than God, that's where the heresy comes in.
I think so. And they got terribly excited about this, terribly, and it's quite baffling to us in some ways now.
Yes, but the culture was such, the education was such, wasn't it, that people wanted something simple and straightforward. When you were emperor, you had to rule all these people unless you said,
this is the official version.
Yes, it is very understandable that it happened at that time. And it's the reassuring feeling for hope that things are different now than it could be.
Yes.
Progressed.
So we do our theology democratically, whereas they did theirs sort of dictatorially because of the political landscape.
It's terrible for Pope Francis. He's got this problem in China.
Yep.
With the faithful Chinese church and the official government-approved
Chinese church. Yes.
And he's having he's supping with the devil with a long spoon, isn't he?
I guess it's like the church in Germany, and probably the Orthodox Church under Stalin.
Augustine suffered from it, didn't he, with the Donatists?
Yes, the Donatists, yes. Mm. Yes. Yeah, how much do you... How much do you compromise officially to be allowed?
And he's having to ask bishops who sat it out, stayed there faithfully, to resign, to let in.
Yes.
And being a Jesuit, he's going to be critical.
Indeed. Yes.
What I'm really interested in is what is John's theory of the Trinity?
That would be a whole session, wouldn't it? Does he? What do I want to say first? As you can tell, I'm trying not to say very much.
I don't understand why this is the Trinity, because he's talking about the Father and I.
It's not the Trinity in this verse, but this was one of the verses that was used to discuss the whole business. But I suppose not just the Trinity, the nature of Christ. Mm. So in that sense, yes, Jane, it's a good point that, I mean, John has got a very underdeveloped, one might say, in later terms, anachronistically might say, view of the Spirit. So John has got a huge amount, more than the Gospels say about the Father and the Son, but only he really uses those phrases, apart from about six verses, a little clump in Matthew's Gospel that feels like it's come from outer space when you read it. John only talks in this Father-Son way the whole time. Constantly. He says, the Father, the Son.
But then you've got Jesus saying, I will send another Comforter.
Well, this is where you get the... It's where you get the Holy Spirit under a different name of the Paraclete.
Yeah.
And is the Paraclete identical to what has later become, what is known as the Spirit in Luke? Is that the same as the Paraclete in John? And then you get the double procession of the Holy Spirit, which is a very familiar phrase, which is where
the Book of Wisdom.
where the Western Church and Eastern Church divide. The Eastern Church don't say proceeds from the Father and the Son, they only say proceeds from the Father. The Book of Wisdom.
The Book of Wisdom. Well, it takes the concept of wisdom from being somebody who can knock up a reasonable chair out of wood and a saw, to it actually grows up and becomes the Holy Spirit.
Yes.
Processes is extraordinary.
Sirach, or the Book of Wisdom. And it's one of my Christmas sermons. If Jesus had been a girl, what would he have been called? And the answer is Sophie. Because Sophia, John, I think, would not have used Logos in chapter 1, which we're doing in January, by the way. He wouldn't have used Logos, the word. He would have used Sophia, if it weren't feminine, I think. Which is rather what you're talking about, I think. Because wisdom gets actually what technically we call hypostasized, but I think we would say personified. That wisdom is not a thing. Wisdom turns into a person. Do you remember in the early chapters of the Book of Proverbs, wisdom stands in the street and calls, come and sup with me. Mm. All that stuff. Wisdom is a person, a woman.
Mm. There's a lovely Latin hymn, the Veni Creator.
Yes, yes.
Sine tua numine nihil est in homine nihil est notion. Without yours. I don't know how to translate that so well. Numen.
Yeah, no, well, I was going to say I could translate that for you, but numen, you say yes. Yes. Yeah. Yep. Well, there we are. I think let's draw to a close in a moment.
Can I just ask?
Yes, please do.
It's not the Trinity he's referring to, because you're going to deal with that later, but I'm just wondering why in my NIV translation, you've got my Father who's given to me is greater than all. So he's talking about the Father first. And then suddenly in verse 30, he says, I and the Father are one. Are one. As if he's sort of hinting at...
Well, 29 is utterly utterly untranslatable.
Right.
It isn't only untranslatable, there's about six different versions of the Greek, because they couldn't work it out either. So every monk who wrote it down tried to make it make sense.
Okay,
so it's a very difficult verse to argue from anything from.
I just wonder why he put himself first. Jesus put himself first as I.
Yes.
Rather than putting the Father first.
Yes.
In one of the verses. Almost as if he was hinting at part of the Trinity, well, without the Spirit, Holy Spirit.
I get nervous arguing anything from verse 29 because it's...
It's not 29, it's 30.
30, oh, right, okay, sorry, beg your pardon.
Put my devil's
advocate. You may.
Quite simply, my theory of the Trinity is that it is to prove that we're not supposed to define things, that it is a mystery.
That's how it should be.
Yes.
We're supposed to think. I mean, Jesus is always asking questions.
Yeah.
But we're not supposed to. It
certainly defies explanation, doesn't it?
Yes.
Like not of those things we just accept.
Yes. I think, depending who we're talking to and everything, we need to have enough account of it so we don't look silly. What I mean is that it's helpful to other people that we don't believe nonsense. Yes. I mean, you know, Mormons believe nonsense. They believe that Jesus went to America. So, I mean, you know, you need to recognise if nonsense is being talked, so you can say, well, thank you for all that, but actually I won't bother too much with it. And in a sense, we need to be able to say to people who are not Christians, what we believe is not silly. So I guess we need to have enough sensibleness to say about the Trinity to help that process, but as we work it out, no.
But it's something that we humans have created. It wasn't in the gospel. We got all the little hints like this.
Yes. Yes.
There is no mention.
No, the word Trinity. The word Trinity isn't. That's right. Trinity doesn't come. The word doesn't come in the Bible. No.
I think it was in what. I think it was the last, I can't remember how the hymn starts now, but there's that wonderful phrase in a hymn, a loved hymn, describing God as being ineffably sublime.
Yes.
In other words, sublime but totally undescribable.
Yeah.
How would you succinctly explain the Trinity to somebody who was seriously asking?
I would say that we are monotheists, that we believe that God is one. But that when you said that, you haven't finished saying everything said about God. That God, one suggests singularity. It suggests that there's like a point. And that God is bigger than that. That all the early texts about God in the Bible are plural. And the Jews are very monotheist. And yet their word for God is plural, Elohim. That they use the concept of plurality to talk about the majesty of God. For Plato and people, God was the unmoved mover, a single point, a monad is the technical word, at the heart of the universe. And we say God is not that. We say that God is that within God there is loving fellowship and community. That something that is just a sort of point means nothing to us. That not only between God and us, but within God is relationship. When we say God is love, you can't be love unless there's loving. And so within God there is love. God loves God. God is plurality, not singularity, although God is one. There is relationship within God. At the heart of all things is not some theoretical point. At the heart of all things is loving fellowship and community. And Christians have refined that, not always very helpfully, by saying it's a threefold community. This community of love is a threefold community, Father, Son, Holy Spirit. But I'm saying in some ways that's a bit you could ignore if you like. Most Christians have chosen to talk about it that way. In the old language, Father, Son and Holy Spirit. In new language, Creator, Redeemer and Sustainer. Because that's non-sexist, for one thing. And so if we talk about fathers and sons, that doesn't help young women. It can really irritate young women. That God is very masculine. God isn't masculine. God includes as much feminine as God includes masculine. So to use only masculine words about him is profoundly unhelpful to modern young women. So many people prefer to talk about God as Creator, Redeemer, Sustainer, rather than Father, Son and Holy Spirit. But I'd say leave all that on side. Never mind the threefoldness. That's just a sort of Christian habit of how we talk about God. The important point is that God is a loving community in which we are invited to be involved. There's a quick 3-minute attempt.
Creator, Sustainer.
Yes, Creator, Redeemer, Sustainer. Father, Son, Spirit. Because don't forget how this masculine language actually hinders some women. And rightly hinders them. We must acknowledge that rather than sneering at it.
Yeah.